This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. You may have played one of those video games where you rumble over a pile of rocks, you smash into a tree, and the controller shakes and buzzes to give you that feeling of a crash. Well, that 3D touch sensation is called haptics. That video game controller was haptics 1.0. Haptics are showing up in smart devices, too. You know that little tap notification you get from your smartwatch? Well, that's a haptic. And scientists are working on haptics for surgery, prosthetics, and all sorts of possibilities. How do you digitize the feeling of touch? What could it be used for? Let me introduce my next guest. Catherine Kuchenbecker is director of the Max Planck Institute for Intelligent Systems in Stuttgart, Germany. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
We won't be taking your calls this hour, but we'd like to hear from you on Twitter, if you like, at SciFry, and talk to one another about what we're talking about. I know you've worked on a project where you created palettes of textures. So instead of picking a paint color, you can pick a texture that feels like cotton or wood. Tell us about that. What are you measuring to create textures? Is it all vibrations?
Great question. So the goal of that project was to be able to record how surfaces feel to cut touch with the same accuracy that we can capture them with a camera. So we actually call it haptography, haptic photography. And we do record vibrations, but also other signals that your body can feel and that we can sense with engineering sensors. So imagine you take a tool and you drag it back and forth over a piece of leather or say a rough piece of stone. You can feel the tip of the tool bounce across the little bumps on the surface or be dragged. It might be more difficult to move across the leather. And also you can feel how hard or soft a surface is. And so we created a little tool that we call a haptic camera, a touch-based camera that can record all those sensations. And then we do a bunch of math and make a model so that then when you go touch a virtual version of that piece of leather or that stone, we can create sensations that make it feel almost as though you're touching the real thing.
So when I do the touching, am I touching a trackpad? What am I touching?
Well, we have a bunch of different instantiations. The first one we worked on was a Wacom tablet computer. So it's like an iPad, but with a stylus in your hand. So you can touch different places on the screen, and we could put a picture of, say, the stone on the right and the leather on the left. And then as you drag the stylus across the picture, you would feel like the tip was going over the stone or the leather, even though it's really just going over a glass. And the way we do that is we have a little motor. It's kind of like a speaker, but it plays vibrations for your fingers, and it would vibrate the tip of the tool back and forth depending on how fast you move or how hard you push, in a very similar way to how a real tool would feel. And that was kind of the first version, 1.0, as you might say, of this haptography system. And 2.0 was using a more sophisticated haptic device where you can move in three dimensions, going closer to like virtual reality. So you can move the tool around in 3D space and feel, oh, here's like a sphere or a cube or a big statue. And we could portray these sensations, the vibrations, and also how hard it is to move along it. You could tap on it and feel, oh, this stone is really hard and the leather or foam is really soft. And you could feel all those things together with an image of the virtual object.
So is that really one of your goals, to use this in a virtual reality environment?
Yeah, that is definitely one of the major goals. You've probably heard that VR is on the rise and pretty exciting. Lots of people see ways for it to be used, say, for medical training or online shopping or, of course, gaming as well. And we believe that the more realistic sensations we can bring in to such virtual environments, the more believable they'll be. I mean, life is a lot more than just what you see and what you hear. You can't do anything in the real world without reaching out and touching something, and you should be able to feel it.
You mentioned using it in medicine and surgery. How would you do that? What kind of uses could you make?
Yeah, so certainly one big opportunity is to improve the kind of video games that doctors train on. There's a big movement in medicine right now to help, say, surgeons or dentists or other medical practitioners practice on a realistic computer simulator before they try out, say, suturing or drilling a cavity on a real human. There are a lot of ethical reasons, and even for the doctor themselves, they'd like to practice and know they're good at something before they do it on a person. And so improving the quality of what you feel in a lot of these simulators, sometimes those simulators are just like a fake plastic tooth, and sometimes they're computer-based, like a sophisticated computer game. And so we work on improving what the surgeon or the dentist, the doctor would feel. So that's kind of the first simulation. The second one, we also work in my research lab a lot on robotic surgery. And now here, there's no virtual world. There's a surgeon controlling a robot across the room to do surgery in deep inside a human patient. So the company that has made robots like this is called Intuitive. They make a Da Vinci robot, and they get used all around the world every day to let doctors operate deep inside a patient. But that commercial FDA-approved version has absolutely no touch feedback, so the doctor can't feel anything of what they're doing.
So is there a practical version using haptics on the horizon?
Yeah, so that's another big topic my research group worked on when I was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia for the last 10 years. We invented, basically taking what I described before, the haptography idea, where we record all those sensations and then model them. Instead of modeling them, you can just transmit them immediately, sort of like a microphone and a speaker, where we measure what the tools are feeling and play it for the surgeon's hands right away. And so their right hand can feel what the sensors on the right tool are feeling, and their left hand can feel what the tool sensors on the left hand or what the left tool are feeling. And there are many, many different kinds of things we could measure. And surgical instruments are already pretty complicated and expensive. And so the trick for this project was to figure out which of those signals that we could measure, which of the touch-based cues would have the most bang for your buck, the most benefit. And for this, we really focused in on vibrations. They hadn't been studied very much before. Most people thought about forces. If I'm pushing on the tissue, how hard is it pushing back? But you can actually kind of see that with your eyes because tissue deforms. And so instead, we looked at the higher frequencies, things more like the sounds, the tools hitting each other or cutting tissue or colliding with something outside the view, or that we can measure those signals quite easily with tiny sensors that just sit up on the robot arms, and then we can play them for the surgeon's hands to feel using very similar motors to what we put on the original texture pad, that stylus on the tablet computer.
You know, I would think a great place for this would be in the invention, the development of self-driving cars or car steering wheels or something where, you know, you'd feel a vibration if some car was coming up next to you or behind you and maybe wake you up even if you are going to sleep.
Absolutely. Haptics is a great way to get a driver or user's attention because it's private and it's salient. You can feel it easily when it's designed well. And so there are lots of researchers and car companies too are really interested in using this. And even it does exist, in lane keeping, sort of help you stay in your lane. A lot of modern cars are what's called drive-by-wire, meaning there's no physical connection between your steering wheel and the tires. And so it's kind of like that remote control surgery that I was talking about. A computer and some motors have to do to connect what you feel on the steering wheel to what's happening at the wheels. And you want it to be not just that the wheels go where you point them, but that you can feel it if you start bumping into the curb, or maybe the automatic lane keeping assistants could share control of the car with you and kind of communicate with you through the steering wheel, almost like a driving teacher holding a second steering wheel on the other side of the car, perhaps. Did you want to hear about how we hack the vibrations to make them work even a little better?
Oh, now you have my attention. Absolutely. We like to get into the weeds on this program.
It's just a little, it was a nice side story because when we record, say, what a tool feels as it drags across, say, that piece of stone, the tool is actually shaking in all directions, left and right, up and down, in and out. So we can put a three-axis accelerometer vibration sensor on there and measure all of those vibrations. And your hand holding the tool can feel all of them. But really interesting, you can't feel which way it's vibrating. At higher frequencies, like above 20 cycles back and forth in a second, you don't have a sense of the direction. You're kind of direction blind. You can only feel the fact that it's vibrating. And then let's say we're trying to let the surgeon feel what their scissors are doing inside the patient. You could, of course, have three motors and output the up, down, left, right, and in-out vibrations. But that's heavy and complicated and costly. And so we came up with an algorithm to take the three axes of vibrations and turn them into just one, because your fingers can't feel which direction the vibrations are happening in. So if we do the algorithm right, we can basically find a loophole in the sense of touch and take advantage of it to engineer better, more cost-effective, simpler systems.
Do you think that this kind of stuff is underappreciated?
I certainly think the sense of touch is underappreciated. We as humans are really used to being able to feel what it's like to move our bodies around and the responses we feel. But you know better what it's like to close your eyes or be in a dark room or be in a situation where maybe you can't hear. Your sense of touch is always there. And so we often take it for granted. As a researcher, I also work on giving robots a good sense of touch. So autonomous robots, helping them, say, pick up objects so they can put them away in the dishwasher or hand something to a human in a safe and like really reliable way. And when you try to program robots to do tasks like that, you really start to see how important the physical contact haptic signals are for coordinating these movements in the real world. Interpersonal connections are really powerful. That's actually a very common request. People who've had an amputated upper limb, like let's say they've lost their hand, it's not just that they want to be able to pick up their coffee. They would really love to be able to hold hands with their loved ones. And so that the emotional side of touch and physical contact between people is really important. We have been working on hugging robots in my lab recently and trying to make a robot that delivers really good hugs.
Wow. You know, you're right. That is a very emotional and would be a very useful thing to have over the miles.
It's something we're looking into, and give me a few more years and I'll have a PhD student and maybe we'll see if it might have some true benefits. Could it really uplift your mood or help figure out how you're feeling or help people stay in touch long distances? That's some of the things we're thinking about.
All right. We'll have you back in a couple of years, okay? Write it down.
I'd enjoy that. Thanks so much.
Catherine Kuchenbecker is director of the Max Planck Institute for Intelligent Systems in Stuttgart. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you're a science fan like I am, it's easier than ever to peruse scientific journals and track down real scientific papers on everything from the Big Bang to the latest genetic innovations, new medical research. Forget trekking to the local library to find a dusty copy of a scientific journal. You know, you can find it all online. And yet, just as easy to find online are websites peddling packets of wellness pills for $90 a month, designed to put pep in your step or rev up your metabolism. And oh, by the way, none of that's been proven or vouched for by the FDA. Or websites where so-called climate skeptics, we'll call them climate change deniers, tear down the peer-reviewed research of well-respected career scientists with their own back-of-the-napkin calculations that supposedly disprove the science. And yes, they're the anti-vaxxers. They're alive and well, too. This is the age, of course, of alternative facts, after all. But today I want to take a trip back to an earlier time, to the 1950s, when pseudoscience was alive and well, with some ideas far more colorful than the ones we have today. Ideas like the hollow Earth, or events on Earth being controlled from space, almost like science fiction. And the guy who chronicled it all was a writer and mathematical puzzle enthusiast named Martin Gardner. He wrote all about it in his book Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science. Gardner passed away in 2010, but my next guest grew up reading Gardner's columns, and he's here to help us survey the pseudoscience. Jordan Ellenberg is the MacArthur Professor of Math at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and author of How Not to Be Wrong. He joins us from Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back, Jordan.
Great to be on the show again.
Nice to have you here. Just a reminder that we're not taking calls today, but you can tell us what you think on Twitter at SciFry. Jordan, like you, I was a great Martin Gardner fan. I loved his columns in Scientific American.
Yeah, I used to get the dusty copies of those books. I don't know why you denigrated going to the library and getting dusty copies of old books. It's one of the great pleasures of life as far as I'm concerned. And that's certainly how I read Martin Gardner's books when I was a kid in the Montgomery County Library.
Did he inspire you to go on to better things?
Yeah, I mean, you know, coming across those books, I think probably every kid who is interested in math, and I think this is still true today, just as it was in the 80s when I was a kid, you know, comes across these books, these volumes of his collected columns from Scientific American, which he wrote for almost 30 years. And it's just a revelation, you know, on every page, some kind of fascinating piece of mathematics that's accessible to any interested party, like from a child to an adult. I mean, what he wrote about didn't really require a lot of technical training.
Yeah, that's he was really great. Let's talk about the book Fads and Fallacies and some of the pseudoscientific ideas Gardner reviews in the book. And let's begin with the hollow earth and the flat earth theories. People really believed in those.
They did. And, you know, even today, I think we use a flat earther as a kind of generic term for someone who's absolutely resistant to the pull of all evidence. And he writes very entertainingly about people's kind of competing cosmologies. By the way, I discovered that flat earthism is not over. There's flat earth Twitter. I recommend that you go on Twitter and sort of like delve into this community and its disdain for people like you and me who are called globe heads, those of us who believe in the spherical earth.
I would be afraid of falling off that Twitter place.
Exactly. Well, as they would point out, the fact that you don't fall off by them is very potent evidence that we live on a flat earth.
If it's spinning
so fast, they say, how do you not fall off? How does the water not all slosh off? There's lots of deep questions on flat earth Twitter.
Well, I'll have to check it out.
But of course, yeah, what's amazing is that there are people for whom the flat earth theory is not exotic enough and who believe that, as you said, that the earth was actually hollow. Some people thought there was a very popular theory that the earth was hollow and there was actually five spheres concentrically arranged within each other. There was a big hole at the North Pole where the water sort of flowed from one earth to the next. And then people wanted to mount expeditions to go through the hole and find out what was going on in the inner earths.
This wasn't having anything to do with The Hobbit, was it?
Oh, I think this was pre-Hobbit, actually. I think this, but yeah, Middle Earth, I guess. I don't think that's what Tolkien had in mind, but he was drawing from an even older tradition than that.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, that's got to be like the most exotic theory you can come up with of how the Earth is actually shaped. But no, there's a whole nother people who believe that, yes, they've said that we agree the Earth is hollow. Okay, there you're right. But we live on the inside of the shell, not the outside.
Wow.
And the sun is in the middle.
Wow.
So this was a huge controversy, right? I mean, these people who are like, well, we agree on the basic point that the Earth is a hollow shell. But then, you know, there was very fierce dispute about whether we lived on the inside or outside surface.
It's amazing. Gardner also wrote about a guy named Charles Fort and the Fortians. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, Fort was an absolutely fascinating figure. He was there's a whole Fortian society built around his views. He was very interested in – he's sort of famous for being interested in reigns of frogs. He was actually interested in reigns of all kinds of subjects, reigns of worms, reigns of gelatinous substances from the sky, reigns of food. This was somehow the idée fixe that he kept on returning to, these ideas of mysterious things falling out of the sky that couldn't be explained by science. He kind of hung out in the New York Public Library just exhaustively cataloging all these reports of inexplicable phenomena and writing about them in his magazine, which was called Doubt. He was this kind of extreme skeptic who just wanted to mess with people's ideas that they understood the world.
The director of the movie Magnolia says that the famous scene where there's a hail of frogs falling from the sky, that he was inspired by Charles Fort.
How did the frogs fall from the sky?
Absolutely. And one interesting thing, so Gardner writes about Fort in depth, and one interesting thing is that, you know, reading Charles Fort, he writes this book, Low, in 1931. Low, it's very exciting. Low, exclamation point, that's in the title. And it really does read like this kind of masterpiece of early 20th century modernist literature. You sort of can't help but be compelled by it. He was actually very good friends with Theodore Dreiser, who was one of the novelists, Dreiser, who was one of the people who really sort of brought him into American literary culture.
Have you got a section you could read to us? Give us a flavor of what he was like?
Yeah, I'll just read you like the very beginning of this book so you can imagine it being 1931 and you picking up this book off the store rack. And so here we go. Here's the beginning. Part one, chapter one. Ready? A naked man in a city street, the track of a horse in volcanic mud, the mystery of reindeer's ears, a huge black form like a whale in the sky, and it drips red drops as if attacked by celestial swordfishes. An appalling cherub appears in the sea. Confusions.
Wow.
Wouldn't you keep reading that? Wouldn't you say, like, something's going on here?
I think a made-for-TV movie is going to break out somewhere. Absolutely right. Well, and another name that everyone knew back at that time was Velikovsky, who had some, shall we say, unorthodox ideas about planetary science and the formation of the solar system in the famous book that he wrote, Worlds in Collision?
Absolutely. Fort did too, by the way. Fort did not believe in the hollow Earth. He agreed the Earth was a sphere, but he thought we lived inside a larger sphere, which was made out of a gelatinous substance, and it was chunks of that which would sort of break off and like fall into our atmosphere and fall to the ground. Velikovsky, on the other hand, he had something in common with the flat Earth people, which is that a lot of what they were trying to do was to develop a scientific theory which explained or ratified what was said in the Bible. This was a very popular activity. Huh. And Velikovsky had a whole, can I say cockamamie on the radio?
You certainly can.
About how a comet erupted from Jupiter, flew past the Earth in a very complicated and gravitationally impossible loop-de-loo, part of the Red Sea, stopped the sun at Jericho, and then settled into orbit and became Venus. So in his view, Venus is this kind of antique comet that had flown out of Jupiter, caused the miracles of the Bible, and then kind of settled down into a stable orbit. And this was incredibly popular. It was a huge bestseller, and you know, Velikovsky went through this whole sequence of complaining about how he had been victimized by the scientific establishment. Why did they refuse to accept his theories? I mean, I remember even in the 70s when I was a child, I mean, this book was still a going concern with tons and tons of copies being sold and tons of arguments and television programs about this theory and whether it was being unfairly neglected.
Back in the 70s, I recall it that Carl Sagan, as he was rising and becoming popular and a TV star and even in Cosmos, felt like he had to take on this theory, had to take on Velikovsky and challenge him.
Absolutely. This was sort of taken seriously enough. In the 70s, of course, you know, it was the age of pyramid power. It was the age of biorhythms. I mean, we do sometimes speak as if in this moment we're in an age of alternative facts. But you know what? We kind of always have been. I mean, what the interest of alternative facts is changes. The locus of attention changes. But that phenomenon is always with us. And I think reading Gardner on writing in 1951 about fads and fallacies in the name of science, it's startlingly contemporary. That's what I would say.
Yeah. The more things change, the more they remain the same. Speaking of contemporary, the strange thing about Gardner's book is that some of those so-called fads and fallacies were predictive of the future. They sound pretty familiar today. I'm going to point out a few. Vegetarianism, organic farming. Yeah.
Right. And what's interesting is those phenomena are quite old, but I think the justification is quite different. So, for instance, nowadays, if we're interested in organic farming, it's because we sort of know that chemical pesticides like remain in the soil there. Like, you know, prolonged exposure is actually bad for workers. In those days, at the dawn of organic farming, I mean, as Gardner tells it, I think it was much more of a sort of mystical enterprise where there was a belief that the Earth was kind of a living being with its own rhythms that for sort of karmic reasons we had better not disturb. That soil kind of lost its vitality in some scientifically unspecified way when fertilizers were used.
Mm-hmm. As a fellow mathematician, Gardner was a mathematician. What makes this so attractive to talk about these things to you?
I mean, I think, let me put it, I'm going to come back to Charles Fort for a minute because he's such an interesting figure, partly because no one really knows whether Fort believed in his own theories. There's sort of two competing accounts of Charles Fort. One, that he sort of truly believed in his arcane cosmology. But the other theory is that he was kind of like an Andy Kaufman-like performance artist whose whole goal was just to sort of create an atmosphere of skepticism, doubt, and confusion because he thought that sort of science was too sure of itself. And I think that sense of there's a pleasure in feeling you have access to arcane secrets, to mystic things that somebody doesn't want you to know. That's very appealing, and I think people play on that sometimes intentionally, sometimes in order to sell you something that they want to sell you, and sometimes just because they've told themselves that story and it's so appealing to them that they want to share it with the world.
So do you think that this book, Fads and Fallacies, could get a new audience today?
Yeah, I think you can pick this off the shelf right now and read it, and although the things being referred to are different and many of them have been forgotten, you'll feel like it's very relevant to the present day. And of course, Gardner is like such a spirited writer that certainly his style has not aged a bit in the, 60 years or more since this was written.
Talking with Jordan Ellenberg, who is a MacArthur Professor of Math at University of Wisconsin in Madison. And this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And since, let me ask, since you're a mathematician, should we ask, is there such a thing as pseudo math?
Oh, sure. I get emails every day from people invested in pseudo math.
And how do you answer them?
Usually I don't. I've learned from hard experience that it seldom ends well. I do look at them, though. I mean, it's and I do sometimes answer them if I feel that they're truly in good faith, which sometimes they are, and sometimes I get good results that way. But yeah, I think the nature of pseudo-math has a lot in common with the nature of pseudoscience, and that people are really attracted to the idea that they're going to knock off, like, the sacred cow, like the big actor. So I think that's why sort of exotic cosmology is so popular, because people nobody wants to sort of falsify some not very well-known scientific theory, right? They want to be like, I knocked off Galileo. I knocked off Einstein. Boy, were those guys wrong. They thought they were such big deals, but let me explain how it really is. And so I think in math, it's the same thing. People like to do things that are known to be impossible, like trisecting the angle or squaring the circle. I mean, people still, even though those were proved to be impossible hundreds of years ago, people still do them.
Huh. Do you think there's anything we can learn from Martin Gardner's approach to pseudoscience that we might do as well in this age of so-called alternative facts?
I mean, I think it would be great for there to be a new Martin Gardner. It would be great for there to be a dozen Martin Gardners. I think partly because, in my view, he doesn't really try to shut things down, right? He's sort of a very understanding person, a sort of very plain-spoken person. You don't get the sense that he's kind of putting himself above people who sort of have fallen prey to some exotic theory. I think it depends. I think if they're a scam artist, then yes, he's rather acid towards them. But I think in general, he sees them in some ways as temperamentally similar to scientists, people whose sort of inner fire is to understand, but somehow they've gone tragically off track somewhere along the way.
Mm-hmm. And I saw from your reaction before when I asked how do you react to pseudo math that you have realized, I think like a lot of us have realized, is that sometimes you cannot change people's minds by presenting them with evidence.
Yes, I mean, that's definitely true. I mean, I will say in the cases where I've had productive interactions with, I mean, it has happened and it is like really very satisfying. And I think over time, I think I've learned to tell who truly wants to know versus who just has a chip on their shoulder and they want to like show the establishment who's boss. Mm-hmm. I think the people who are just in it to show the establishment who's boss, it's very hard to change their mind, because if you don't swallow what they say, then you're part of the establishment.
What do you think it's time for you to write a book like Martin Gardner's book?
Let me put it this way. I think in order to write about what Martin Gardner writes about, you do have to have a thick skin. I mean, you do have to be willing, as you know, Martin Gardner, he writes about, well, now it's called Scientology. Then it was called Dianetics. And, you know, he was officially declared a suppressive person by the Church of Scientology back in the day. I mean, he certainly, by what he did, he ruffled lots of feathers and he made lots of enemies. I mean, I say like he was somehow a very humane and nice guy, and I think he was. But nonetheless, people don't like it when you call them a fraud in hard copy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. You do have to be ready to suffer those slings and arrows.
And he was certainly, you know, he was a lifelong, he was one of the founders of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of the Paranormal. So he was certainly sort of a scourge of people who made extravagant claims for telepathy and precognition and the psychic powers that they claimed to have. So he certainly threw a hard shoulder when he wanted to.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, Jordan, for taking time to be with us today. Fascinating.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jordan Ellenberg is the John D. MacArthur Professor of Math at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and author of How Not to Be Wrong. Thanks for joining us today. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Summer is blockbuster movie season. Entertaining, flashy action, superhero stunts, but real physics? This year's slate of high-octane superhero movies got us thinking about whether anything our favorite fictional heroes do has a shot at being real. Could Wonder Woman act fast enough to stop a bullet with her bracelets? Could Thor punch the Hulk without knocking himself over? So this week we're bringing the mighty hammer of mathematics to bear on these impossible-looking stunts. They're geeky, I know, but stay with us on this because joining us on our test of phony physics is superhero movie and physics expert Retta Lane, associate professor of physics at Southeastern Louisiana University and author of Wired's .physics blog. Welcome back to Science Friday, Rhett.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin our journey through the physics of superheroes with who else but Wonder Woman.
Be careful of mankind, Diana.
Whoa, bullets flying everywhere in this one, because, of course, it takes place during World War II, and that got us thinking about the physics of blocking bullets. Now, wouldn't all these bullets, wouldn't they knock Wonder Woman down? How do you deal with that, Rhett?
So, you know, this is a great example of your classic introductory physics problem. You have a bullet coming in, and it deflects off. We can calculate the momentum of that bullet, and looking at how it, let's say it bounces straight back. And you can, from that, say the momentum has to be conserved and Wonder Woman would have to be pushed back also. But the mass, if you look at the mass, momentum is mass times velocity. And so the mass of the bullet times its velocity compared to the mass of Wonder Woman, bullets actually don't have that much momentum. They don't really knock you back that much, even if you're wearing a bulletproof vest. So she can deflect these bullets and not get knocked back. And that's not really a big problem with Wonder Woman blocking bullets.
And could a normal person ever bring up their arm fast enough, though, right? These bullets are coming pretty fast. She has to bring her bracelet up to block the bullet.
Right. Now, that's a much more superhuman feat. So if you just take some basic guesses about the bullet speed and how far away you can see it, let's say it's maybe 30 meters before you can even see the bullet, so to know where to block it. That gives you just a small reaction time that you have to take your hand and move it all the way up to wherever the bullet is. So it's probably, if I calculate that, it's going to be around 43 milliseconds. So that's very, very short amount of time. And so during that time, she would have to take her arm, she would have to move it up, increase the speed, and then decrease the speed over a distance of, I'm just going to approximate about 1 meter. So when you're increasing the speed of this hand, that's increasing the kinetic energy. So that takes energy. And if you do that in a short amount of time, then we can calculate the power. Power is change in energy over change in time. So it's a pretty fun problem. And doing that, I get a power that she would need to have of 76,000 watts. And you can convert that to horsepower like a car, and that's about 100 horsepower. So just to block, in order the energy, the power she would need to move her hand up in order to get that bullet in time, we're talking like a car.
That's why they call her Wonder Woman.
That's exactly why they call her Wonder Woman. That's right.
What about all those different bullets? I mean, the clip we played had a bunch of machine gun bullets coming at her. Could she actually hit them all?
Well, then you'd have to move your hand for each one. So it'd just be continuous 100 horsepower that you have to exert. And just for comparison, a normal average human, if you're riding your bike at a good speed, that's about 100 watts. A professional athlete can do that for, you know, maybe 300 watts. And for short amount of times, you could possibly, very, very short amount of time, do maybe 1,000 watts, but not 76,000. So she is definitely a superhero. That's why they call her Wonder Woman, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not gonna argue with that. Let's move on to our arachnid hero, Spider-Man.
Finally, here we go.
Good evening, Peter. Oh. You have 576 possible web shooter combinations.
That is awesome.
Oh. Let's talk about that web because it's Spider-Man's main mode of transit. As we all know, he swings from building to building, right? It certainly looks cool. But how do we know that that's actually faster than running on the ground is?
So, again, it's another great introductory physics problem because if you have Spider-Man on the end of a web, it's just like a pendulum. It's just like a mass on the end of a string, and it swings down. So as he swings down, he increases in kinetic energy until he gets to the lowest point, and then he slows down going back up. So that's your basic pendulum. But if you look at from where he started to where he ended, and you measure the time it takes, you can get his average speed. Now, this I'd like to point out is what I call a Tarzan swing. So, Tarzan, Lord of the Apes. And he grabs one vine and he swings to the next vine. So he goes vine to vine. And that's the easiest way to calculate because it's just a normal pendulum. Then there's the Spider-Man swing, which he swings and then lets go and flies through the air and then shoots another web. So it's a little more complicated. But the average speed for a Tarzan-type swing depends on the length of the swing, the length of the spider web, and the angle that he starts with. And so you can calculate this for best-case scenario of maybe, 30-meter web with an angle of about 45 degrees, and it's around 8 meters per second or 18 miles per hour. And so that's the speed that you could probably run that fast. So you may not be gaining too much. If you do a much larger swing with a Spider-Man jump at the end, you can go quite a bit faster, up to about 16 meters per second. It's still in the running speed range, but then you think about other things. Maybe I don't want to be down on the ground. Maybe I want to be swinging so everyone can see me because I'm Spider-Man, right? And I want to be seen. Or maybe I don't want to interact with the people on the ground. Or it could be a number of reasons. It just looks cool. I mean, I would not want to be watching a movie with just a running Spider-Man. I want Spider-Man to swing. So, even if it's not necessarily that big of an advantage, it just looks so cool.
Yeah, of course, if you want it running, we could always call in the Flash to come in.
That's right.
And to do his thing. Now, we always see Spidey he's shooting out spider webs all over the place. I mean, there's got to be a limit to what he can carry in his arm, mustn't there?
Yeah, I mean, in the one of the movies a while ago, there was no limit because the webs came out of his hand as a biological thing. But in the original comics and in their latest movie, he builds web shooters that use a chemical. So we can estimate the volume of chemical that he would need for his webs based on the volume of one shot. So if you shoot it, let's say it's five stories high and it's a thin stream, only a millimeter radius, you can calculate the volume of that one shot. And for that one shot, the volume is really small, but it's the same as a 3-meter-long pencil. That's what I like to think of. That one shot is like a 3-meter-long pencil. So if you want 50 shots, I'm just picking 50 because,
right.
I mean, you got to have a number.
Sure.
And then you have some serious volume of the webs that he would have to have on his wrist. That's like 50 3-meter-long pencils he's going to have to carry along with him to have all of those webs. And it would look a lot different on his actual body.
Do we know if there's anything in the real world that comes close to having the properties of Spider-Man's web?
Yeah, there could be. So the web, if you look at what he's done with the webs, he doesn't just swing from them, but he's stopped falling cars and things like that. And based on a falling car that gets stopped, it's much larger force than just to hold a car. And I get about 40,000 newtons it would have to support. And the amount of force that a cable can support depends on its thickness. So if I look at all of the same 1-millimeter radius cables, steel would just be 6,000 newtons, so it's not enough. Nylon rope is not anywhere near. Spider silk, because he's Spider-Man, that would be about 3,000 newtons. But the one that could work is carbon nanotubes. Those are around 200,000 newtons that it could support. So it's a science thing, right? And Peter Parker is a scientist, so carbon nanotube webs would feasibly work, and I think that would be pretty cool. In my mind, he's shooting carbon nanotube webs, so that's what I'm going to stick with.
Are they thick enough, though? Can he get all that stuff good at net?
Yeah, he can't get – it won't be thick enough, but yeah, I'm going to let it slide. I'm still going to be a Spider-Man fan and just let that one slide.
Okay, yeah, because if it can hold a space elevator, it can hold Spider-Man. All right, let's move on to our next clip for the upcoming movie Thor Ragnarok. It's setting up what is essentially a gladiator-style duel between two of our favorite superheroes. We have Thor and the Hulk.
Yes! We know each other. He's a friend from work.
Oh, come on.
that was the trailer. It's kind of funny, wasn't it?
Yeah. And that's all we have to go on right now. The movie's not out.
Yeah, we'll have to wait for that to come out. But let's look at a preview of what to expect. This got us thinking about what would happen if Thor punched the Hulk in midair, if they met midair, and the physics about superhero punching in general.
Right. I think the most important physics idea here is that if the Thor punches the Hulk, then he's exerting a force in the Hulk, but forces come in pairs. They always come in pairs. So no matter what Thor pushes on the Hulk pushes back. It's not that he has a choice. It's just the way forces work. And this force does something. Forces change the momentum. And momentum is mass times velocity. So there's a big difference between the Thor and the Hulk, and that's the mass. The Hulk's much bigger, so he most likely has a larger mass. So they jump up in the air, Thor punches, and those forces do different things because now that Thor has a smaller mass, in order to have the same change in momentum, his velocity is going to have to change more. So Thor is going to jump up. He's going to hit him, and he's the one that's going to get pushed back way more than the Hulk, even though they probably want to depict this as Thor really hitting the Hulk and sending him back, but it can't work that way. So, yes, he may hit him hard, but Thor is the one that's going to get thrown back, not the Hulk.
This seems to be like the simplest form of a physics calculation you could make of all the ones we're talking about.
Right, and it really helps. In the clip, what got me excited is that he punches them in the air. So you don't have to worry about forces from, you know, who's pushing on the ground more or anything. They're not touching the ground. So it's a great collision in the air that you could easily calculate what's going to happen.
You know, these sound like great teaching moments for, you know, a teacher to say, go out and see the movie. We'll talk about the physics when you get back.
That's right.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Okay, leaving the superhero battlefield for a second, what about Transformers, a blockbuster, popular blockbuster movie franchise? We all know we've seen the Transformers, but do they square with the laws of physics? Could we actually have something like a Transformer in the real world?
So I think we do have something like a Transformer. We have, you know, planes that turn into helicopters and cars that can fly. They're not great, but I mean, we can do that. But I think the interesting thing about the Transformers is how would you build a large robot? Because they're much bigger than a normal human. And I think that's the interesting part. This is the age-old story of scale in physics. And it's that small things aren't the same as big things. And that may seem obvious, but if you think about it, the proportions of things would have to be different. So I like to use an example of a box, a cubicle box. That's 1 meter on a side. So it's 1 by 1 by 1 meter. I can easily calculate the volume of it to be 1 times 1 times 1, which is 1 cubic meter. And I can also calculate the surface area if it's sitting on the ground, and it's 1 times 1, so 1 square meter. So it has a volume, which is related to its mass, and it has a surface area. So that's all fine. Now I'm going to double the box. I'm going to make it twice as big. So it's 2 by 2 by 2, so it has a volume of 8, and the surface area is going to be 2 by 2 with the volume, a surface area of 4. So by doubling the size, the length of one size, I've increased the mass by 8, but I've increased the surface area by 4. So it's going to push, if it's sitting on the ground, it's going to push down a lot more, and it's going to compress into the ground more because of the surface area compared to the mass is much smaller. So if you build a robot, a big robot, their legs would have to be much thicker than a normal human. You can't just say, oh, it's a big human, it's just big. It would look a lot different because its legs have to be much thicker to support its much, much, much larger mass. And we see this in real life. Look at a chicken. Look at the legs of a chicken compared to the legs of a dinosaur, a Tyrannosaurus Rex. They have very, very thick legs because they're so much bigger. So big things are not the same as small things. You can't just make a giant chicken. That wouldn't work.
And I guess this is something any math or superhero nerd can do at home, right?
You can. Yeah, they can and they should. And the great thing about these kind of problems is that they're at all different levels. You could just take, let's say, who's faster, the Flash or Quicksilver? They both run fast and they're in different universes. And you can find how far did they go and how long did it take and what's the speed. That's a very simple calculation. And you can compare it and, you know, have a nice argument with your friends about who's faster. Or you could do something very complicated like Spider-Man swinging and jumping. That's not so easy. So there's a wide range of problems that can, you know, satisfy your interest in comic books and physics, and everyone can do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rhett, thank you for taking time to be with us today. As one former famous movie reviewer said, we'll see you at the movies.
Well, thanks for having me.
Rhett Allain is Associate Professor of Physics at Southeastern Louisiana University and author of Wired's.Physics blog. One last thing before we go. Every now and then, I like to remind our fans and listeners that public radio and programs like Science Friday are dependent on public donations. It's through your support that we are able to geek out about the physics of Wonder Woman or talk about the dangers of pseudoscience. And just like an asteroid crashing into Earth, even a small gift can make a big impact. So find out more about how to support the work we do. Go to sciencefriday.com/donate. And thanks. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Haller. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. We had engineering help from Neil Rausch and Brian McCabe. And thanks to the rest of the folks at NPR. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.